Welcome to the second hour's readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Small West Texas Businesses Trying to Survive by Aaron Douglas and Sergio Chapa from the Houston Chronicle. In Kermit, 50 miles west of Odessa and just south of New Mexico, life often feels like one big weekend in a casino, said Rodney Hayes, an owner of a flower shop. Thousands of workers flock to Kermit and other West Texas towns that dot the Permian Basin, betting their money and lifestyles on an oil boom that stretched over much of the last decade. But even as Kermit boomed with the Permian's hot streak, Hayes said there was always the sense that the town could lose it all. It's kind of like playing a slot machine, he said. You don't know what oil is going to do until it does it. Oil did it last month, tumbling into negative prices for the first time in history as Saudi Arabia and Russia flooded the market with crude and the coronavirus pandemic shut down large swaths of the global economy, cratering energy demand. Prices have rebounded, but they remain below $20 a barrel and well below the break-even point for most companies. People in Kermit remain stunned that in just a month, a barrel of oil went from near $50 a barrel to costing less than 64-ounce party-sized drive-through frozen margaritas. Oil settled at $19.78 a barrel Friday. Companies that bet big on the Permian, one of the world's premier oil fields, started to shut down. Thousands of workers lost their jobs in a matter of days. State officials proposed mandated production cuts, a tool not used in Texas since the 1970s. Regulators vote on the proposal Tuesday. In Kermit, Covia Corporation, a minerals and materials services company, last month laid off 82 of its local employees at a now-idle sand mine as hydraulic fracturing has ground to a halt. At least two more frack sand mines have closed or severely cut back operations near Kermit, ripping through the local economy as companies that haul and deliver the materials also are forced to cut back. For workers such as Jana Chapman, a logistics manager at an oil field services company, that means her job is over. After a year of living at Diamond RV Park near Odessa, it's time to pack up and go home. This is the trifecta of things that could kill the oil field, she said, mentioning the presidential election, the coronavirus, and the price war. She planned to head to her mother's home in Alice, near Corpus Christi, at the end of the week. There's no work here for me to find anymore. The logistics operators, truckers, mechanics, and others who keep oil fields pumping crude will not only leave behind the pump jacks, but also grocery stores, boutiques, and restaurants that depend on the influx of workers. Entering what could be the worst bust the region has ever seen, locals are hunkering down, cutting expenses and trying to survive until, they emphasize, not if, oil prices bounce back. This business has been through how many busts, and it's made it, said Janie Robertson, a manager of Buddy's Drive-In, a family-owned business known for its steak fingers in Andrews, 35 miles north of Odessa. We may not make a profit, but we're not going under. That's my goal. Kermit's population fluctuates with the boom and bust cycles of oil. The 1980s oil bust, when prices plunged to about $10 a barrel, began a decades-long decline for the small town off the Texas-New Mexico Railway in Winkler County. The population fell from about 8,000 down to below 6,000, according to a Stanford analysis of census data. The shale revolution, spurred by the fracturing boom, revitalized the Permian and Kermit with it. The population climbed to nearly 6,500 people as workers piled into RV parks and pop-up workforce housing. But a new oil bust is pummeling Kermit and West Texas again. Sales tax revenues have plummeted 25% in Kermit from a year ago. In nearby Pecos, tax revenues are down 20%. Companies that support the oil industry are wondering how to survive. Retailers, fitness facilities, and salons popped up to cater exclusively to oil field workers. Now their customers have packed up and left. Sammy Castaneda, a natural gas processor mechanic, leased space to open a small fitness center in Kermit last February with the idea that workers needed an outlet to stay healthy instead of drinking themselves to death. Measures aimed at slowing the spread of the coronavirus shut down the gym. The oil bust could keep it closed for good, said Castaneda, who initially invested $10,000 in the business and took out around $80,000 in loans for equipment. With the price of oil coming down, then it doesn't matter if I get a loan or not, he said. If I'm not making money, then I'll eventually lose it. Hotels that usually bustle with men traveling on oil business are vacant. RV parks that host workers moving from job to job are emptying out. Workforce housing camps that sprouted up in the middle of the desert in the last 5 years have slashed rates to try to keep workers in town a little while longer. Ralph McInvale, partner of Permian Lodging, a workforce housing provider that manages camps throughout the Permian and Delaware basins, said occupancy is down to an average of 45% across the company's 6 properties. At the end of 2019, occupancy was near or at 100% at the properties, he said. Some rooms even doubled up. Day shift and night shift workers often share rooms to save space. And money, we've got a triple hit, said McInvale. Not only COVID and the slashing of the price of oil, but the fact we've got overproduction. Everyone is getting hurt out here. The coronavirus is definitely a factor in the hit that West Texas is taking, but McInvale and other local business owners, from retail shops and restaurants to oil field service companies, blame most of their sales drop on oil prices. This is going to be a fight, said McInvale, who has worked in the oil and gas industry since 1979. You're going to have to keep cutting wages and keep cutting revenue and find a way to come out on the other side. Other business owners are experiencing their first bust. Socorro Barajas, the owner of FR Workwear and Safety Supplies, an oilfield clothing outfitter in Pecos, moved to West Texas 3 years ago because she heard the money was good. Not anymore. In just 1 month, her sales have dropped off by 80%. Everybody talked about oil and the jobs, and that's why I came, she said. It's bad right now. We're trying to survive. The small communities outside Midland and Odessa, the two hubs of the Permian Basin, are in shock. Workers were laid off so rapidly that many are still loitering around the outskirts of town, social distancing in their trailers and watching their neighbors unhook and pull out. Some are worried about exposure of the virus during day-long trips back home. Others don't have the financial incentive to leave. With business shut down by the coronavirus, there's hardly any point in spending the money to move if there's no job to move to. I would love to pack up and go home, but right now it's just not financially feasible, said Nikki Falk, a logistics dispatcher. I've gone through all my savings. 40 days after her layoff as a logistics dispatcher for Cott Oilfield Services, she's still living in her fifth-wheel trailer outside of Midland. at Goldenrod RV Park in Gardendale, where she estimates 75% of her neighbors have packed up and gone home. The coronavirus has kept her isolated in West Texas. Her 70-year-old stepmother lives in the house Falk owns outside of Fort Worth, so she fears putting her at risk. To cope, Falk, who has just received her first unemployment check after weeks of waiting, adopted a 3-month-old terrier mix puppy. "If it weren't for her, I probably wouldn't be doing well, to be honest," she said. "It's depressing out here. The feeling is just somber." Kenny Comstock, executive pastor at Crossroads, a non-denominational Christian church in Odessa, said his congregation has asked for help with managing anxiety and depression in recent weeks. "A lot of prayers are about the price of oil." When oil went negative, he said, there was a sense that this could be a desert town. The boom brought prosperity to West Texas towns, but it did not come without costs. The large influx of workers to tiny towns meant pop-up trailer parks, now abandoned, crowding the town. Sand trucks barreling down two-lane highways tore up the roads. Traffic choked country roads. But even as lifelong residents like Hayes, the Kermit florist, grumbled, they knew the economy was indebted to higher oil prices and the people who flocked to West Texas to cash in on them. The boomtowners shop in grocery stores, go out for barbecue, and buy flowers to apologize for working long hours away from their partners. Mother's Day is typically one of the biggest holidays of the year for Hayes, but this year he estimates the shop's sales will fall by at least half. If he can't keep the losses to 50%, he may have to lay off his 3 workers and run the shop alone. "They spend money," Hayes said of the oil industry workers. "And that part, yes, we will definitely miss."
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Sunday, May 10th, 2020, Section A. "Today is time to celebrate Mom," by Ruth Campbell. There will be a lot of celebrating around the Chaner Vasquez households this weekend, marking Mother's Day and birthdays this weekend. Adela Vasquez and her daughter Monica Chaner said they have a lot to be grateful for this year. Vasquez, a longtime ECISD counselor and administrator, and her husband Gilbert have 2 children, Monica and Patrick, and 4 grandchildren. Shauna and her husband Chris have 3 children. Patrick Vasquez has 1 child. This year, the family will celebrate Mother's Day with a cookout and some of Vasquez's famous guacamole dip. They also will celebrate Vasquez's birthday, which falls on Monday. Mother's Day for Vasquez's mother will be Saturday. "It's a special day," Vasquez said. "My husband and I love our kids very, very much. We kind of focus on them a whole lot. We always have. So Mother's Day is just a wonderful day for gatherings and phone calls to my son and gratitude. I'm very, very grateful to have my kids and my grandkids. They have brought a lot of joy to me." Every year on Mother's Day, Chaner thinks of how grateful she is that her mother is still with her, because, like she mentioned, there are many who don't have their mom, so I always thank God for that. "Then I turn around and I look at why I'm a mom, and I look at my 3 kids, and they're the reason I get to celebrate this day. And really, they are my heart. They're my purpose. So that is my passion. That's the one thing that when I leave the earth, I want them to feel that they were blessed with a good mom," Chaner said. Her counsel to mothers is to love your children and be forgiving of yourself and of them. "Love is the greatest gift that you can give your kids and yourself and your family. That would be my advice," she said. Vasquez says mothers should be loving and nurturing, but also give them hope, because life isn't perfect for anyone, and always look up, even when you have a bad day. Mamas have bad days too. You have to wake up the next day and say, hey, I get another chance at this. Keep going. That's what I've tried to teach her. We've both endured an illness. We've endured other things, and that's the big message I would give to my family and give to kids. Always have hope, no matter what, Vasquez said. I've lived 71 years. Monday will be 71 years. I've gone through a lot of assassinations, a lot of wars, shootings, whatnot, but never a pandemic. Never a pandemic. It's earth-shattering at times. It can be. You know, we're still eating. We still have our homes, our families, so there's a lot to appreciate, she added. Asked if they had any Mother's Day traditions, Vasquez and Shawner said they don't really, except for Vasquez guacamole dip, which is incorporated into gatherings of family, friends, occasions, and holidays. Vasquez said they also use chili Colorado dressing. Vasquez, a Texas Tech University graduate, is a student assistance services counselor for the district and works on the helpline set up by ECISD. She and Shawner agree there are a lot of lessons for youngsters during this time. I hadn't realized this is the group that were 9/11 kids, and then the senior group. Then they started out the year with the shooting, tragedy, and now COVID. So if anything, their really being immersed into life can change at any given moment, Shawner said. I think that is definitely a life lesson because life will always throw curveballs. It's not always going to be smooth sailing, she added. Vasquez worked for ECISD for 37 years and then returned for 7 more. Personally speaking, I started off working directly with kids, and over that long period of time, I have kind of gotten into the administrative end of it. So to come back and work directly with kids again has been extremely rewarding. Her father died in 2017, and that same year, she said there were 8 deaths at Permian High School. That impacted our campus a lot, so I focused on them, and it kind of helped me through my own personal grieving and transition. This year, like Monica said, the shooting to start off our year that way, it only brought chaos, she said. And fear, Shawner added. Vasquez said the students were settled down and ready to go again. Then there was spring break and the pandemic. Shawner, also a Texas Tech graduate, is the director of Discover America at the Odessa Chamber of Commerce. She has been at the chamber a little more than 2 years. I substituted for a little while when my kids were younger. I wanted to still be a stay-at-home mom, but they were all in school, so I would sub at Reagan. I substituted for 2 or 3 years, then stayed at home. I was going to get back into teaching, but I was diagnosed with breast cancer, so I went through that. That stopped me there. Then I ended up at Hope House for 3 years. I was the director of West Texas Gifts of Hope, which serves cancer patients. So I felt like I was kind of a mission. That was kind of a mission for me after that. I did that for 3 years, and then I started at the chamber, she said. Remembering Raxton Jones by Michael Bauer. The Odessa community has rallied around the Jones family over the years as their son Raxton battled a rare form of muscular dystrophy. On Saturday, the community again showed its support after Raxton's death earlier this week. Raxton, who passed away May 5th at the age of 5 at the National Institute of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, was remembered at a memorial service by local law enforcement and local fire department at Sunset Memorial off Highway 80 Saturday. He's been fighting for his life the past 5 years, and during those 5 years, he's changed a lot of those lives, Raxton's father, Ryan Jones, said, who is a captain and paramedic for Odessa Fire Rescue. He's inspired a lot of people. He's going to continue his legacy with his donation of himself to gene therapy research. Even with Raxton gone, his family is eager to see the impact that he has had. My wife and I are blessed to have had Raxton around for 5 years, Ryan said. We're very excited to see what the future holds and how many lives Raxton is able to save and how many lives that he changes for the better. We're going to be burying him in the next few days. It's not going to be a sad time. It's going to be a very exciting time. Over the years, the community has been there to support the Jones family with fundraisers to help Raxton. One of those included a benefit that was hosted by Jason Payne, owner of Payne's Gym, back in 2015 when Raxton was 9 months old. Other benefits have been held and the family has been grateful for the support. They've been a super big support with Raxton, Ryan said. Our family, our friends, we've been able to raise money for research for him. The purpose has been to not only save his life, but to save other kids' lives as well. Hospital docs say ERs are still open, by Ruth Campbell. Although most of the medical community is focusing on COVID-19 right now, top doctors at Medical Center Hospital and Odessa Regional Medical Center say people should still come to the hospital if they are having symptoms of a heart attack or stroke. We know that there are individuals out there who have chronic illnesses, heart issues, lung issues, that are maybe experiencing significant health problems, deteriorating health, that are somewhat nervous about going to the emergency department to be evaluated, especially if they're really sick, Dr. Donald Davenport said. I think what they need to understand is that from a hospital setting, the hospital is still a very safe place to go get evaluated, especially the emergency room if you have an emergency, period. Davenport said MCH has set up the emergency department to screen people and separate COVID-19 patients from those who would normally be seen in the ER. Some of the precautions, especially in the emergency department, are screening for symptomology associated with the COVID-19 virus and triaging patients who are potential virus carriers away from those who are screening negative, and then moving them and triaging them back into the emergency department and separating people out of the rooms within the ED to decrease the risk of contamination or infection within the ER. Davenport said. People who come to the hospital are asked to wear masks. I think that the medical community strongly recommends that individuals who are out in public wear a mask, Davenport said. Our universal mask policy within the hospital is essentially everybody in the hospital who is in direct contact with a patient will be in a mask. So if an individual were to arrive to the emergency department without one, we would make sure that they have one available to them. Again, he said that in and out of itself helps lower that risk of transmission. But again, I think it goes back to screening and then isolating those individuals who might be suspicious for the COVID virus. He noted that the emergency department numbers are much lower than they were in January and February before the pandemic began. There was a point in time where 2/3 of the normal traffic through the emergency department was gone, so we were seeing 1/3 of the patients in the emergency department, Davenport said. During busy times, the ER at Medical Center saw upwards of 180 to 200 patients a day. At one point, Davenport said, they were down to 60 patients in one day, which is a marked decrease in the number. Davenport said the fear of going to the ER is probably a combination of things, including being exposed to COVID-19 and educating the public about using their primary care physicians and the urgent care clinics as a tool to help identify who needs to go to the emergency room and who doesn't. People can call their primary physician to discuss symptoms, use the primary care physician or an urgent care clinic instead of going to the ER. Broken bones, births, and other emergent situations are still handled by the hospitals. I think people are thinking more about health problems now than they have previously, and that doesn't say people shouldn't be using the emergency department. I think what the explanation is people are trying to decide, is this something that I can go to my primary care physician or urgent care rather than going to the emergency department, Davenport said. He added that if people have a known heart condition and chest pain, that needs to be taken care of right away. To deny those symptoms and say, I'm just going to wait that out in a lot of instances, may not be a good idea. And again, I think we have a lot of opportunity. We have a lot of opportunity to continue to educate the public about chronic health issues, acute health issues, outside of what's happening with the virus. It's interesting because we think the COVID virus is here and we're making recommendations to people that everybody's health issues just stop and are on the back burner, but that's far from true. There are still processes that need to be undertaken with regard to management of chronic health problems and in screening for health diseases that we just can't put away because we're scared of contracting the virus, Davenport said. We've got to work in parallel with that to keep people healthy, to keep them educated, and to make sure that we can help them out the best we can. Davenport said all the offices of the different physicians are open, whether it's orthopedics or ear, nose, and throat. There are recommendations that have now been made by the governor, by the Texas Medical Board, with regard to restrictions in seeing patients within the office, but it's not telling us we shouldn't see those patients in the office. We have talked about telemedicine, doing audio-visual over social media or other platforms, but now we are back to seeing patients in the office more often, Davenport said. There are restrictions, such as a physician and patient need to wear a mask to have a face-to-face conversation. This is a protective measure to help stop the spread of coronavirus while patients are being treated. If you think you're having an emergent situation, that's what the emergency department is for. People have to be involved in their own health care, Davenport said. Odessa Regional Chief Medical Officer Dr. Rohith Saravanan said it's not about the type of surgeries that have resumed, it's about performing medically appropriate surgery. The algorithms that we follow allow us to screen out anybody who is a potential for COVID. So there are two algorithms. There's one screening algorithm that's happening at the doctor's office, which basically goes through and asks about risk factors like travel history, symptoms, exposure histories, things like that, that will immediately exclude people even prior to being scheduled, Saravanan said. The second screening happens on the day of surgery in the hospital. Those screening questions, they repeat everything that goes on in the doctor's office. They look for those risk factors, the symptomology or exposure history, and then it looks at hospital resources. Do we have enough ICU beds? Do we have enough blood products? Do we have enough medical surgery beds? And once it goes through that, then it asks the surgeon to put the patient in a risk category, Saravanan said. If they are in an extremely high risk category, patients would then be asked if it's okay to reschedule their procedure. If they are not at high risk, they would be allowed to go on. If you think you need to go to the hospital, check with your primary care doctor or use the CDC self-checker for COVID-19. A primary care doctor will tell you if it's okay to stay home, if you should come in and see them, or if you should go to the hospital right away. They'll give you that advice. With coronavirus specifically, there is a CDC self-checker. If you go to the CDC website, the first link on top is learn more about COVID-19. And then in that website, there's a big button that says self-checker. It's going to screen you for emergent medical conditions and advise you to go to the ER if you need to, or it might say call your healthcare provider to discuss further, or it might say you're not much of a risk, it's okay to stay home, Saravanan said. Pet clinics. Fix West Texas has scheduled vaccination and microchip clinic May 16th by appointment only. Clinics will be set up from 1 to 3 p.m. at Grace Christian Fellowship, 3450 Billy Hext Road, 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. at Haverty's, 4110 Loop 250 Frontage Road in Midland, and 7 to 8 p.m. at First United Methodist Church, 208 East Santa Ana Street in Stanton. Venmo payment is required with 24 hours of booking to secure appointment. No refunds. Book appointment at fixwesttexas.org. For more information, email registration at fixwesttexas.org or visit tinyurl.com/YAMJXTA6.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Monday, May 11th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, "Don't Mistake Higher Oil Prices for a License to Pump," by Julian Lee, Bloomberg. For the first time in weeks, the oil news isn't all bad. Output cuts are starting to make big inroads into supply, and demand is beginning to recover ever so slightly, as something more like normal life resumes in parts of the world. But there's a double risk on the horizon. Just as lifting lockdowns too soon could bring a second spike in virus infections and deaths, loosening the hard-fought restraint in oil production too soon risks a second oil price collapse. With the easing of draconian measures to restrict people's movement, the first signs of demand picking up are still very tentative and localized. This is about beginning to claw our way up from the depths of April's demand destruction. It is still far from the year-on-year growth we experienced before the novel coronavirus struck, or from any kind of meaningful start at drawing down ballooning stockpiles. But it might be just an initial turning of a corner, as long as there's no need to stop the global economy again to keep COVID-19 outbreak under control. The way China has gotten back to work is instructive. Congestion on roads in major cities has soared during peak commuting hours, but it remains depressed outside those times, with traffic levels still well below normal during the weekend and on holidays. Meanwhile, people are choosing to drive rather than take public transport, boosting gasoline demand, a trend that's likely to continue for a considerable period of time. In big cities around the world. In Beijing, for example, subway passenger levels are still more than 50% below pre-virus levels, according to analysis by Bloomberg NEF. As some parts of the U.S. begin to ease lockdowns and people take to the roads again, gasoline demand has slowly started to recover after falling to more than a 30-year low in the first week in April. And gasoline stockpiles, which reached record levels in early April, have started to come down. But consumption is still only at a level last seen in the early 1990s. And efforts to reopen businesses and get people back to work will have to become much more widespread before it gets back to anything like normal. Jet fuel demand was hit even harder and is still down by about two-thirds from five-year average levels for this time of the year. It is showing little sign of recovery, with planes still grounded and much uncertainty over when and whether people will embrace flying again. By contrast, diesel demand was never hit as hard as other transport fuels, in part because trucks have kept on trucking. And the onset of planting season across much of the Northern Hemisphere may provide a boost for distillate fuels in the coming weeks. Nevertheless, stockpiles are still rising, in part because refiners are producing more of the stuff as they try to minimize the amount of jet fuel they're making. But we are still a long way from seeing much relief for crude producers, and they need to continue exercising restraint. On the supply demand of the equation, reductions are finally kicking in. On May 1st, the output cuts of nearly 10 million barrels a day agreed to last month by the so-called OPEC Plus group of countries, led by Saudi Arabia and Russia, finally came into effect. Early signs are that big cuts are actually being implemented by both countries. Russia production of crude and condensate, a light form of oil extracted from gas fields, averaged 9.5 million barrels a day in the first 5 days of May, according to Interfax Information Services Group. Saudi export shipments are also down, according to tanker tracking data monitored by Bloomberg. Market-driven declines are also happening elsewhere. Weekly data for the last week of April show U.S. production falling below 12 million barrels a day for the first time since February 2019, excluding the impact of Tropical Storm Barry. Monthly figures show it's been in decline since November, confirming what I wrote here. However, there is still too much crude being pumped out of the ground and into storage. U.S. crude stockpiles are still rising, even though the rate of increase has started to slow. Consultants Rystad Energy see U.S. production falling by a further 1.3 million barrels a day by the end of June, based on early communication from producers. But let's not get carried away. This is just the start of the beginning of a recovery, or maybe just the first glimpse of the end of the collapse. Rising consumption and falling production are only just starting to narrow the gap between supply and demand, and the massive inventory buildup hasn't stopped yet, much less gone into reverse. The real risk may be that when all the financial pain of output cuts and the human cost of job losses starts to pay off with higher oil prices, producers take it as a signal to restart the pumps, as if the whole oversupply problem got solved overnight. The output restraint has to last long enough not only for supply and demand to be brought back into line, but for stockpiles to be brought back down again. It's important for everyone to keep that in mind. While the impact of the collapse in the oil price and production volumes has created hardship for all those who depend on the business, the effect is particularly devastating in places where oil is the lifeblood of the economy and where there are no reserves to draw on. You think it's bad in Midland? Try Wari, Nigeria. This article is entitled City: Death Was Sixth This Month, 12th Overall, by Stuart Doreen. Saturday marked the third straight day that a Midland County resident died because of complications from coronavirus. The City of Midland and Midland Memorial Hospital reported Sunday that a day earlier, a man in his 60s who died was being treated and passed away at Midland Memorial Hospital. No other details will be released at the request of the man's family, according to the city. The death was the sixth coronavirus-related death this month, according to Reporter-Telegram records. The Texas Department of State Health Services reported Saturday that Midland ranked tied for 20th of all counties in terms of coronavirus-related deaths, despite being 41st in total number of confirmed cases. The city reports this man was not a resident of Midland Medical Lodge. Prior to Saturday, the last 9 coronavirus-related deaths involved Midland County residents involved those staying at Midland Medical Lodge. The man who passed away Saturday was the third overall that was not a Midland Medical Lodge resident. Of the 101 confirmed coronavirus-related cases, 35 have recovered, 25 are in home isolation, 29 are in the hospital, and 12 have died, according to information from the Midland Health Department. This article is entitled Specimen Tree to be Focal Point of Downtown Park, by Stuart Doreen. Centennial Park officials planted what they expect will be the focal point of the $18 million downtown project. Last week, a crane helped plant a live oak tree, or the specimen tree, on top of the mesa in the park located next to the Bush Convention Center. Once the park opens, Centennial Park hopes the tree will serve as a gathering place for all Midlanders, according to the city's public information Facebook page. The specimen tree has a 17-inch diameter and was trucked in from Austin. In February, park officials said they expect a June 17th completion date. Centennial Park is located in the heart of downtown Midland, in the space previously occupied by Centennial Plaza and the Midland County Courthouse. The four-acre park, according to the city, is centered around the lawn and performance pavilion, with tree-lined promenades running along its perimeter. An interactive water feature functions as a splash pad by day and a fountain by night. Additional features include a dog park, concessions kiosk, grove seating, and a nature-style playground. Centennial Park is a public-private partnership between the City of Midland and private donors, and will be privately operated, managed, and programmed by the Midland Downtown Park Conservancy, according to the city.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, May 11th. Nurses are worth celebrating. This was written by Carol Cates, the chief nursing officer at Odessa Regional Medical Center. Early in November of 2019, when most of us had never even heard of the coronavirus and COVID-19, the American Nurses Association announced it was joining the World Health Assembly, the governing board of the World Health Organization, and global campaign of elevating and celebrating the essential contributions of nurses in the world by naming 2020 the International Year of the Nurse. I'm pretty sure when this idea was brought up as an idea sometime in 2018 or early 2019, no one had any idea that nursing in 2020 would involve a global pandemic that has claimed over 200,000 lives worldwide, and that nurses and nursing would be pushed into the headlines in such a dramatic fashion. 2020 was chosen as the International Year of the Nurse because it is the 200th anniversary of Florence Nightingale's birth. Nurses Week always ends on May 12th, Florence Nightingale's birthday. Florence Nightingale is the mother of modern nursing. She is also considered a major influencer on the field of statistics because she applied statistical theory to research, specifically infection control, long before anyone else even considered doing so. Florence Nightingale, during the Crimean War, took a small group of nurses into a British field hospital on a request of the Secretary of War because the death rate for wounded soldiers was horrific. When she arrived to the field hospital in Scutari, near Constantinople, she found it had been set up on top of a cesspool which was contaminated with sewage, that the patients were unbathed and left in their bodily secretions, and there were rodents and bugs throughout the building. Florence Nightingale established a sanitation process for the facility, a hygiene process for patients, and a kitchen where nutritious food was prepared in clean conditions, and a laundry so patients had clean clothes and linens. Those efforts dropped the death rate by 70%. She did those things with compassion and respect towards her patients to the point she was known as the Angel of the Crimea throughout the British Empire. After the war, she went back to England and established a hospital and nursing school. Her work in the Crimean Peninsula totally changed the perception of nursing. Before Florence Nightingale, nursing was not seen as a respectable profession. After her time in the Crimean Peninsula, nursing became an honorable vocation. Today, that respect continues. Every year, the Gallup organization puts a poll of the most trusted professions. Nursing has won that poll every year except one since it began more than 20 years ago. The year that nursing wasn't number one, firefighters were awarded that honor, and they should have been. That year was 2001, not long after 9/11. Nursing has had a lot of challenges and a lot of changes since Florence Nightingale's time. Practicing nursing in 2020 is very different than it was in Florence Nightingale's time, but the best things that Florence Nightingale gave nurses has endured. An understanding of holistic care, that a patient needs not just medicine, but a clean environment, good food, and physical, emotional, and spiritual care to get better when they are ill. She understood that nursing is a science. She didn't just say a clean environment helps patients get better. She proved it with statistics and research, techniques we still use in nursing today. The International Year of the Nurse looks back to honor Florence Nightingale and the millions of nurses who have come since. But it is also looking forward. While I would not wish this pandemic never happened, it has done more than any ad campaign ever could have done to highlight nursing. We have seen some amazing examples in the last few months of nurses all across the world putting their own lives in danger for someone they do not know. We have seen nurses holding the hand of a stranger in their most vulnerable moments when their families could not. These are not just nurses in New York, or Italy, or China. These are nurses here in the Permian Basin. We have had nurses volunteer to go to hotspots across the country to help their colleagues who are stretched far too thin because their area has been hit hard by coronavirus. Both hospitals here in Odessa have had COVID-19 positive patients, and the nurses here have stepped up to care for them. I have had nurses in the community reach out and say, "How can I help?" even though they don't work in a hospital on a normal day. I think Florence Nightingale would be very proud of her legacy if she could see how nurses are standing up to the challenge of COVID-19. Please reach out to the nurses in your life this week and tell them Happy Nurses Week and thank them for the things that they do for others. If you are a nurse, I am honored to be your colleague. Thank you so much for everything you do. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Ector County confirmed cases, 99. Ector County negative, 1,360 out of 1,573 tested, with 114 pending. 4 deaths. Midland County, 100 confirmed cases out of 1,982 tested, 11 deaths. Texas, 38,869 confirmed cases with 501,776 tested. Total Texas deaths, 1,088. U.S. cases, 1,365,308 total confirmed cases and 80,717 deaths. Find out more online at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC site. Shark Tank. Complex Community Federal Credit Union is taking Shark Tank Virtual, a student competition to help raise funds for nonprofits. Over the last month, local students have created a business plan, financial plan, and a marketing plan, including these promotional videos for a lemonade business that they have created. These students are being judged on each of these plans and a video presentation they will be giving in front of the CCFCU Sharks. Additionally, these students are having a fundraising competition benefiting their chosen local nonprofits as bonus points to help boost their score and win over the Sharks. To view these projects and vote by donating, go to https://ccfculemonadeday.com. Any amount of support is appreciated, and 100% of the money raised will go to the nonprofit selected. Fundraiser. The Boys and Girls Clubs of the Permian Basin is launching a new online fundraiser to replace fundraisers canceled due to COVID-19. During these difficult times, the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Permian Basin, like many other nonprofits, has had to make some tough decisions about the organization and fundraising activities in light of COVID-19. A new fundraiser that will take place from May 7th to May 15th. Opportunities to make direct donations to the Boys and Girls Club, as well as bid on silent auction items like a guitar signed by George Strait, Southwest airline tickets, and more, will be available on this website. The fundraiser is available at https://one.bidpal.net/bgcpb. The new fundraiser receives support from a variety of companies and individuals in the community, including Alpha and Omega, Sewell Family of Companies, Emmett Headley, John Burns, the Garriga Law Firm, Bobby Bland, Community National Bank, Rosalyn Redfern Grover, Double Point Energy, Cooper Construction Company, Salisbury Industries, Frost Bank, AIM Bank, HEB, Synergy Entertainment, and Henry Resources. For additional information about the new fundraiser, visit https://one.bidpal.net/bgcpb. The Centers for Children and Families has received a special donation from SM Energy in the amount of $15,000 to help the organization meet the mental health needs of the community as a premier provider of clinical counseling, awareness, education, and support services. The check presentation for the generous donation took place on May 5th at Center's location in Midland. The Permian Basin has taken a uniquely damaging hit as the COVID-19 health crisis has ignited a trifecta of tragedy affecting our healthcare system, stock market, and the oil industry, your area's lifeblood. The need for mental health relief is rapidly growing as a result. We are committed to helping people in need, especially during these trying times, Executive Director Christy Edwards said. With community partners like SM Energy, we can continue our outreach and service to the people who need it most, and we are truly grateful. Centers is currently waiving an assessment fee for all new clients through the month of May, and is offering 2 free sessions to all healthcare workers and first responders battling COVID-19 on the front line. New clients are welcomed. To make an appointment, call 580-7006 in Odessa or 570-1084 in Midland.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram from Monday, May 11, 2020. J. Anthony Ivey left and his brother Nathan Ivey placed the tables outside the Midland Soup Kitchen on Thursday for customers to take a loaf of bread with them after picking up to-go meals from the front door. The dining area is still closed, but hot meals are being served to-go. Library reopens, first hour for high-risk patrons. Midland County Public Library reopened on Wednesday while taking extra precautions for the safety of patrons and staff. In accordance with Governor Greg Abbott's guidelines, occupancy will be limited to 25% capacity. In accordance with Governor Greg Abbott's guidelines, occupancy will be limited to 25% capacity. Both branches will open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. The first hour of each day, 10 to 11 a.m., is reserved for high-risk patrons, including those who are 65 and older, and children 5 and younger accompanied by an adult, according to a press release from the library. All types of materials are available for checkout, and patrons will have access to free Wi-Fi and public computers. To minimize contact, circulation desks will offer only self-checkout, and services such as printing, copying, faxing, and notaries will not be available. Meeting and study rooms are not open for reservations. High-touch areas will be cleaned every 2 hours, according to the release. Curbside service will be available at the downtown branch only. Virtual programs and digital resources remain available on the library's website and social media. Meeting. County Commissioners, 9 a.m., Auxiliary Courtroom, 500 North Lorraine Street. Prayer for Midland's Leadership. A night of prayer for Midland's leadership will take place at 7 p.m. May 27 at Midland College. The event will include an invocation given by Maybe Foundation Executive Director Mike Goak, song of worship led by Craig King, and a vehicle procession circling the campus. Those interested can meet in the south parking lot of Chapp Center. Virtual fundraiser to benefit Boys and Girls Clubs. The Boys and Girls Clubs of the Permian Basin is launching a new online fundraiser to replace events canceled because of the coronavirus. The digital fundraising event will continue through Friday. Opportunities to make direct donations to the Boys and Girls Club, as well as bid on silent auction items such as a guitar signed by George Strait and Southwest Airlines tickets, will be available at https://1.bidpal.net/BGCPB. The new fundraiser received support from a variety of companies and individuals in the community, including Alpha and Omega, Sewell Family of Companies, Emmett Headley, John Burns, the Garriga Law Firm, Bobby Bland, Community National Bank, Roslyn Redfern Grover, Double Point Energy, Cooper Construction Company, Salisbury Industries, Frost Bank, AIM Bank, HEB, Synergy Entertainment, and Henry Resources. For additional information, visit https://1.bidpal.net/BGCPB. How sick are you? Midland Memorial Hospital offers a nurse triage program, 68 Nurse. The program is designed to help people determine whether their health situation warrants a trip to the emergency room. Midland residents can call the line by dialing 686-8773. The program is free and available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Local nurses are available to help you determine the best place to receive care for your situation. 68 Nurse can help you save time and money by directing you to the most appropriate healthcare option, whether it's a neighborhood clinic, urgent care center, emergency room, or just staying home. Today in Texas history. In 1953, a tornado devastated Waco, claiming 114 lives. Today in history. Today is Monday, May 11, the 132nd day of 2020. There are 234 days left in the year. On this date, in 1947, the B.F. Goodrich Company of Akron, Ohio, announced the development of a tubeless tire. In 1973, the espionage trial of Daniel Ellsberg and Anthony Russo in the Pentagon Papers case came to an end as Judge William M. Byrne dismissed all charges, citing government misconduct. In 2006, lawmakers demanded answers after a USA Today report that the National Security Agency was secretly collecting records of millions of ordinary Americans' phone calls. President George W. Bush sought to assure Americans their civil liberties were being fiercely protected.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or your favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.